And joining us right now is one of the most talented actors in this country. He's a guy that I have followed since he was a little kid, and he's still out there now doing some great stuff. And whether you've seen him on Mad Men or Desperate Housewives or some of the great shows, in fact, movies like The Social Network, he's around. But of course, we all know him as Little Ernie from My Three Sons. And we want to welcome right now Barry Livingston to the program. We had your brother Steely on before, you know.
Yes, Dan is, you know, he's doing a lot of interviews on his various projects. But, yes, he's out there.
Well, you have written a really fascinating book, The Importance of Being Ernie, From My Three Sons to Mad Men, A Hollywood Survivor Tells All. It's a great book.
Thank you.
I really can 100% tell people to go buy it. It's great. But before we get into that, unfortunately, this week, Don Grady passed away at 68 years old. And
yeah, what a tragedy. Yeah, Don has, you know, he's been ill for quite a few years now. And, yeah, finally he succumbed. Yeah, just a great guy. I mean, sounds like a cliche when actors start, you know, play brothers, but you know, really was somebody that we looked up to quite a bit, and my brother and I both, you know, learned so much from him. You know, he was great.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I didn't even know he was ill. Had you been in contact with him and things, or?
I didn't, you know, it's something he kept kind of quiet for a while. I mean, for quite a while, actually. And I did only found out maybe about a year and a half ago, something like that. And, but, you know, he's a private person, was, you know, doing his, what he needed to do to, fight his battle. And, you know, we respected his privacy, and certainly he was trying to maintain his career as a composer. You know, he was quite prolific, and a lot of work for the Disney Channel and Discovery, and so sometimes people get a little skittish when they hear the big C word that you're sick, and you know you want to keep busy. You know, it's so important to somebody who is sick just to keep your life normal. So I think he was very careful, you know, cautious about trying to keep it quiet.
Yeah. Do you have any particular memories of you know, on the set experiences with Don?
Well, you know, Don was just a great musician, and he used to go to school on the set, and his dressing room was built right over our little schoolroom that they had constructed on the soundstage, and Don was just a nonstop music machine, and we would listen to him all day long. You're downstairs trying to learn algebra or Spanish, and Don would be up there pounding on the floor, you know, tapping out some kind of a rhythm to some new song that he was writing, you know, to eventually, you know, we'd take a pole and start beating it on the ceiling of our schoolroom to get him to calm down up there, because he was, you know, he was rocking out half the day. I don't think I'd be a guitar player. Well, certainly wouldn't be a guitar player without Don, or a piano player, because he not only was very helpful in just kind of exposing us to certain music and how to play certain songs. His guitar player in the band that he was in, who a great guitarist named Gil Rigers, who was very young himself at that age, he was probably 15, 16 years old, really became my teacher. And Gil has gone on to become Johnny Mathis's main guitar player probably for the last 25, 30 years. And I think it's the only guy that Johnny has kept on the payroll that he's also his arranger and so, you know, these were all through my Don Grady connection. You know, Don, like I say, his impact on my life was pretty profound and lasting.
You know, you have a very interesting career, and many of us obviously would not know about all the things that you went through without the book. And the book, The Importance of Being Ernie, From My Three Sons to Mad Men, A Hollywood Survivor Tells All, is from Citadel Press. It's available everywhere. But it has in it so many cool things. I wanted to just talk about some of them. First of all, the first job that you got was being cast as one of Paul Newman's children in Rally Around the Flags, Boys, and
yeah.
He ended up getting fired from that job.
Well, yeah, you know, that's, welcome to show business.
Yeah.
That was a good taste of how cruel the business can be. I think I was 5 years old, and it was the first job. I was playing my brother Stan, who was Chip on My Three Sons, was also cast as one of the kids in My Sons. But I was instructed by the director to just look at a TV. We were doing a scene, and the scene required me to just stare at a TV and ignore Paul Newman, who was coming home, you know, through the front door, playing my dad, and he's trying to get our attention. And the gag was, we ignore him. We're just watching the TV and don't pay any attention, no matter what he does. Well, unfortunately, as we were doing that, my eyes to the director looked like they were wandering, you know, off the TV. And so that ruined the gag. Every time we do it, he'd say cut, and then he'd get more and more frustrated with me that he was thinking I was just not paying attention, that I was, you know, starting to look around the room instead of being an actor. And so, anyway, eventually Newman even kind of intervened, because the director, and this is an old-timer, a guy named Leo McCarey, who probably best known for directing Duck Soup with Marx Brothers. He was an old-time screaming director, you know, and he really was laying into me, and Newman said, you know, come on, you know, this little kid, let somebody give me a puppet or something. And they had, you know, one of those big old TV cabinets, there was no TV in it, and he said, you know, I'll just crawl inside that, you know, and keep his attention. And they shot it from a different angle, so you couldn't see him coming in the door. They just wanted to do a close-up. Well, even that wouldn't work. You know, I sat there staring at what I thought was looking at Newman. To the director, he goes, you're looking over here. You're not looking at the TV. Eventually, they took me to a hospital. They said, something's wrong with this kid's eyes. You know, he might be having a seizure. I don't know. As it turned out, I had astigmatism. They gave me glasses. I came back 2 days later to work, and the director and producer took one look at me, and they said, we didn't think Paul Newman's son would be wearing glasses. That's not how we hired him. And so I was literally, promptly fired right then and there, and they hired another kid.
But in essence, though, the buck teeth and the big thick glasses ended up paying off in dividends, because
That did become a signature look. And at that time it was pretty novel, because most kids that were in TV and film, you know, we're pretty much looked like my brother. They were blonde hair, blue eyes, beautiful little children, you know, and mm-hmm. and I looked like, something that came from the wrong side of the tracks. I was, you know, long, kind of Mo Howard bowl cut, and teeth were a little too large and protruding, and then you added glasses onto that, and, you know, I really had quite a look going. But it did. It kind of was a prototype nerd, and you know, as in everything, eventually producers started looking for kids that maybe looked a little more real, you know, a little less kind of, these beautiful little Aryan blonde-haired, blue-eyed children. And so I would work, you know. I started to pick up a job here and there. And next thing you know, I was a regular on the Ozzie and Harriet show and working in films with Debbie Reynolds and Jerry Lewis, Jackie Gleason, all the people that I've tried to put into the book. And then eventually onto My Three Sons. So yeah, it's one of those weird twists of fate that worked out in my favor.
You actually had some really nice words to say about Ozzie from Ozzie and Harriet.
Yeah, well, that was a great family. You know, they were. It's so rare that you come onto a set where it's just a family-owned business. You know, I mean, that's kind of odd in film. Such a calculated kind of put together production. Well, in their case, it was like a little mom and pop plumbing store on the corner. Rick and Dave were the kids. They were on the show. Ozzie wrote just about everything and directed every episode and produced it. So and then acted in it. So it was a very kind of great place to be and a great place to learn. And of course, Ozzie was very, very patient, unlike Leo McCarey. You know, he was, you know, just made sure that, that as a kid, you're well taken care of. And, you know, of course, that's a great thing when you're in show business, because there's a lot of pressure, you know, a lot of time people get hot under the collar pretty quickly.
Yeah. Now, you also did the Dick Van Dyke Show. You don't really talk about it much in the book, but...
I only did that one episode, so, I had one kind of interesting episode where when we were doing our scene, I got the giggles, you know, and they were shooting these things in front of a live audience, so that didn't go over too well. I wasn't supposed to be laughing, but the boy who's playing his son and I, for some reason, you know, we just, I think I wrote it off to, it was the first time I'd ever performed in front of people. I mean, usually you're working on a soundstage and it's, you know, 10, 20 board grips and electricians and people standing on the sidelines could care less, you know, but in this case it was doing it in front of 300 people in a studio audience, and I don't know, I just lost it. I just lost it. I kept laughing, and Carl Reiner, who again, you know, was the guy, the creator, writer of the show, was very, very not particularly happy with me, but again, tried to come out and put the little boy, me and this other kid, I think it was Rusty Hamer, who was
on
that,
yep.
Get us in line. And he whispered some very crucial acting advice to me. And you get the book to read what it was.
Mm-hmm.
He was very calm. We eventually got the scene, and that was quite an interesting episode of Dick.
You did a couple of Lucy shows, and I remember actually one of the ones that you actually have a photo from the show when she gave you the haircut. It's something that actually a lot of us saw that.
Right next door to us. And so she would always, I was already under contract to my three sons, but I wasn't a son yet. I was the friend next door. And she knew of my work, I guess, from working with, some of the teacher films I'd done and the Nelsons. I used to be out of my bike riding around the lot, and she would come blasting by in her little golf cart, you know. She was the studio chief, too. We were working at Desi Lou Studios, which she owned, and she was not only doing her show Here's Lucy, she was producing Star Trek and Hogan's Heroes and a bunch of other shows there, Untouchables. And, she would occasionally whiz by me and go, "Hi, Barry," you know, and first time I heard that, I'd go, "Holy, that was Lucille Ball. She knows my name." You know, it's pretty impressive. And then she requested that I come on, do the show. And the first episode that I did was the one where she gave me a mohawk.
you wrote that to a 9-year-old kid, there was nothing more terrifying than to have Lucille Ball coming at you with a giant pair of scissors.
Yeah, that's probably a literary license, but still, I was really in awe of her. I was a huge fan of I Love Lucy, which everybody, I think, that's the favorite incarnation of all the various Lucy shows. And so, you didn't know what was going to come at you next or how you were going to look. So, but she was a pro, she was great, and the audience loved it.
I find it very ironic that when you were around 9 or so, that Tim Considine, who played the older brother on the My Three Sons show, decided to write an episode introducing a new character, Ernie, and eventually Ernie replaced him on the program. It's kind of ironic.
Well, I pointed to that out to Tim Considine, who played Mike on occasion. he was happy to get the paycheck. He didn't really care, and no hard feelings. That was the... His departure from the show was maybe planned even before, he wrote that episode. He wanted to direct and wanted to write and do some other things, and it just wasn't going to happen on the My Three Sons set. So, but yes, it is kind of ironic and funny, and it was, more than that, it was a very good episode, and it was great for me because it really showcased me on the show, and I think the producers went, we got a talent that's kind of sitting in the bullpen that we can use. So when Tim actually did leave the show, they had to look no further than across the street. That's where Ernie was residing with another family.
And he were pretty comfortable because your brother was already on the program playing playing Chip, and you had Don Grady as Robbie. And I think that one of the funniest parts of the book, talking about William Frawley, who was the original grumpy old man on the show, and was landlord Fred Mertz on the I Love Lucy show, your story about his taunting of Vivian Vance on the set of Lucy.
Well, compounding whatever the issues that they had, because you could see it on I Love Lucy. That their relationship, Fred and Ethel, they weren't the best of friends. Their characters, it was a very antagonistic marriage at best, but off the set, it was pretty icy. And so that carried over, and Bill was like an elephant. He held that grudge forever. Like I said, they shot right next door to our soundstage. We were in stage 11, Lucy was in stage 12. So he would recruit my brother and I to, at lunch, Bill would have his two or three drinks. In those days, you'd get away with stuff like that. I'm thinking, you can't be drinking on the set anymore. But for whatever reason, they overlooked it. They knew he'd come back smashed sometimes. And, you know, we would gather for, at Bill's request, these giant film cans. And when the mood struck Bill, which, you know, was fairly often, he'd say, you know, come on, we're going to go, you know, we're going to war today, boys, or something like that, you know. And then he would go over and he'd hold open the sound stage door where Lucy was shooting, and we'd be standing there with these giant circular film cans. And as soon as he'd hear Vivian's voice, he'd say, okay, shoot them, you know, and we'd frisbee these giant film cans, you know, here at soundstage. And when they'd hit, you know, it just sounded like an explosion, like a bomb going off, and, you know, would ruin whatever they were doing, some scene that Vivian was shooting. And then he'd go, come on, let's get the hell out of here, come on, hurry, you know, and then we'd run back onto our soundstage and retreat and hide out in his room. I don't know if they ever found out if it was us, but, you know, he got a good laugh out of that. That was Bill.
That's funny. Now, after he left, his substitute, you seem to really like him.
Well, you know, I think we like, you know, it's hard to say, I like this person better. The first person I knew was Frawley, and he was such a funny guy, you know. He had that gruff exterior. It was a difficult transition, you know. I mean, because William Demarest replaced him was a different kind of gruff, you know. Frawley was a lovable gruff. Demarest was more gruff. And, but, you know, as you got to know him, he went, yeah, he's a pretty cool guy. And he had some great stories about, you know, his time in the business, because he went back to the the earliest things. I think he was in the first Academy Award ceremony. He was even nominated. And he looked old then, you know, like 29 or 27, something like that.
Mm.
You know, so, you know, fast forward 40 years, he was different. And there was no love between Frawley and Demarest. Frawley would have loved to have continued, but he was becoming sick, even though he wasn't having any kind of real overt things other than memory loss, and he was getting kind of, you know, feeble. You know, he didn't have any kind of collapse on the set, but he couldn't pass his insurance exam. And you have to be able to do that in order to work on a TV show. You have to, you know, be sure you're not going to have a heart attack or something, or, you know, get sick. And if they can catch that before,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're going to save themselves tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars. So they determined they were going to write Frawley out, Demarest in. But, you know, there was no love between those guys. That was tough.
Yeah.
Because they were competitors, and they were both pretty tough characters. So the day that, you know, there was a real awkward day that because they were playing relatives, that was the storyline, and I think they were brothers, and they did a couple scenes together, and Frawley, you know, was handing over, you know, the frying pan, the Douglas family frying pan, to the new cook, and, it, you know, it was tense. There was no, it was very hard, and actually, I think a few months after that episode was shot, and Demarest was now in place, and Frawley was out, I think Frawley collapsed, and died in front of a very famous Hollywood watering hole in Hollywood here called Musso Frank's, you know, had a heart attack on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah. For all those folks who think that when you're a kid that your TV daddy is just like a daddy, Fred McMurray really wasn't like daddy.
Well, not. I mean, he was paternal, and he was, you know, he was a nice man and concerned about us, but not like, you know, taking us on fishing trips or involving himself in our personal lives in any way as maybe some people, Bill Bixby, I think, on The Courtship of Eddie's Father, you know, literally took Brandon Cruz, who was playing Eddie, you know, they'd go on vacations together. You know, I never got invited to a barbecue at Fred's house, or, you know, I think at best at Christmas time, we'd get a nice little Christmas card from the McMurrays. So, yeah, you know, but again, there's no hard feelings. It was Fred, you know, knew who he was. He was a great guy to be on the set with, but he wanted to keep it all business. You know, that was his manner of working, and we respected that. You know, you just went, that's the boss. The boss wants to play the game this way. You go, okay, I like my job. I'm not going to throw a fit because he's not, you know, taking me to lunch today or ever. It's just the way it was.
The book includes some mentions of people like Elvis Presley, Jerry Lewis, Debbie Reynolds, Mickey Rooney, Jackie Gleason, and many other people. And I'm going to let you read that, folks, because it's got a lot of great details into it. I don't want to give away everything in the book here when we talk, but there's just so many things I want to talk about. One of the things I thought was interesting is that after the show was over, you were a young kid, you wanted to stay into showbiz, and a few years after the show went off the air, you ended up in a production of The Skin of Our Teeth, which was a very prestigious production. Went to Hollywood, but still didn't find much going on. And you did get into the drug thing, but it wasn't a thing like a lot of these other child actors who either die or really have these serious problems. It was kind of a transition period for you at one point.
Experimental, you know, you know, you know, I'm not in any way trying to make an advocate for drug use or defend my actions, but I that era, which was the 70s, you know, if you live in Hollywood or New York, that was kind of the recreation, that was the iced tea of the party, you know. I mean, particularly pot and cocaine, and you know, you could have sat in a corner and twiddled your thumbs, I guess, or you could have joined the party. And I just was, well, you know, that seemed to be what everybody else was doing. Okay. But yeah, you know, you eventually, at least in my case, I kind of saw the downside to it, that I thought, you know, it was keeping me from pursuing my career as vigorously as I might have wanted. And, you know, certainly was aware of, you know, the history of drug addiction and things like that. So, you know, I just kind of, I had my phase, you know, probably a year or two, and you know, I just thought this was enough for me, you know. And fortunately, I just had the wherewithal and the willpower to go, okay, you know, I'm done. You know, it wasn't like, yeah, and I can't say it happened. Geez, the next day, I never, you know, took anything. But I just got to that point when this is something I'm going to leave behind. And you know, after a while, it was something I just went, I could be at a party and things were happening and just going, I don't need that. I don't want it. You know, I'm done with it. I've been there, done that. And so that was a phase, and, you know, a necessary phase. As a young man, you know, you're out there trying to learn about life and what works and what doesn't. And you know, gratefully, I learned that didn't work for me. And not that, you know, my career took off after that. You know, I still had to work at it. And that is a very important part of my book, I think, is struggle that it took for me to get my bearings and get my career back on track. And you know, that took another 10-15 years probably of where I did nothing but act. I still was very lucky. I wasn't in any kind of high profile series, but I still was doing some episodic work on, you know, Simon and Simon and Heart to Heart, some of the shows of that era. But yeah, primarily I was doing theater, you know, doing a lot of dinner theater, which there's some funny stories I think in the book about working way outside of Hollywood in some very funny little places. And it was all great. You know, those were all great growing experiences for me as a young man to have that experience of seeing the country, you know, meeting all different kinds of people. You know, you can get so locked into your little sphere out here in Hollywood, and you know, the only people are the same types of people that you meet over and over here. Everyone wants to be an actor, or everyone's got a screenplay. So, you know, it was great to just go out and meet the people and do that for, you know, like I say, it was a good chunk of my you know, middle years in my 20s and 30s, and was doing that.
One of the things I think is ironic, that in a business that is so vanity-centered, so looks-oriented, that your ties to Ernie, the character, and the nerdy look, it's ironic that when you begin losing your hairline, was really a blessing, because then you weren't Ernie anymore.
You know, that's a hard thing. I think when you're so associated, you know, because you are who you are, and suddenly who you are becomes Ernie. Suddenly who you are becomes, you know, JR and Dallas. You know, it becomes very hard to convince people you can do something else. I just did a movie with Bryan Cranston called Argo. This is going to be out in October of this year. And I think it's one of those really rare instances where an actor who became, you know, from Malcolm in the Middle, became so synonymous with the dad on that show. And, you know, and then he had the wherewithal and the good fortune that somebody would cast him in Breaking Bad, where he's, you know, the antithesis of the you know, lovely dad in suburbia.
Right.
You know, and that's just such a rarity that you break a mold. And so, yes, my hair loss helped do that. You know, it was painful at the time. I'm going, wow, you know, and I was getting out the Rogaine and doing all the other things and got a hairpiece and started, you know, maybe I can keep my look. But, you know, the best thing that happened was to lose my look. And I just morphed naturally. You know, at some point I went, oh, well, whatever. You know.
Well, now you're a character actor, and there's a lot more opportunity for character actors.
And I did, yes. And I became, which is what I was at the beginning. You know, all along, I probably dawned on me going, I'm not, you know, George Clooney by any means. Never was, never will be. You know, I'm probably more, you know, Donald Pleasance. I'm more like, who are great character actors, you know, Hume Cronin or somebody like that. I thought, well, you know, I'll be those kind of guys. They have a lot of work out there for accountants, lawyers, scientists.
Well, the folks out there who said, I had a number of people wrote to me and said, well, where has he been all these years? Well,
yeah.
First of all, Barry was on Room 222, Streets of San Francisco, and Ironsides in the 70s, Simon and Simon, Heart to Heart, Doogie Howser in the 80s, The Nanny, Ally McBeal, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman in the 90s. He's been on Will and Grace, West Wing, Crossing Jordan, Two and a Half Men, NCIS, Desperate Housewives, Big Love, and, of course, Mad Men, where you've landed on your feet there.
Well, I have been fortunate. You know, I've worked in every decade since my three sons. And, I'd say the momentum of my career as an older character actor has picked up certainly in the last 10, 15 years. But, you know, again, I think it's attributed to the fact that I have a signature look. You know, I mean, I've got that guy that I can play the teacher, play the boss, play, you know, a dad. And so, you know, that was a blessing for me. And, yes, I've been very fortunate to have a career that spanned over 50 years. And, you know, I guess I'm the one child actor that's not the one, but I'm one of the few child actors that got away. You know, I broke out of that cliche of you know, every child actor is doomed to obscurity and you know, robbing a 7-Eleven. You know,
we got 2 minutes left here. I wanted to. Got 2 minutes left. I wanted to again mention the book is called The Importance of Being Ernie, From My Three Sons to Mad Men, A Hollywood Survivor Tells All by Barry Livingston. It's a great book. Go out and get it. And one of the things that you mentioned, Adam Sandler, who is one of just the nicest people you'd ever want to meet. And in the book, it reflects that, the way he told you, he made you a promise and he kept it.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. You know, I mean, that was a promise kept, you know, made just in bumping into him on a studio lot out in Hollywood here and saying, hey, I really like your movies, you know, and he was a huge fan of My Three Sons, and I said, you know, I'd love to be in one of your movies. Oh, yeah, sure, I'll put you in one of my movies. Yeah, no problem. I was like, oh, okay, you know, and then, you know, every film that he was doing from that point on, I would get a call to come in. Eventually, you know, 5 years, whatever it was, after the point I first met him, and I never saw him between that time, but I was coming, I'd get a call to come in to audition, and sure enough, I finally got a really nice part in You Don't Mess with the Zohan. And at the table read, you know, I feel this tap on my shoulder, and I turn around, and it's Adam. And he goes, see, I told you I'd get you something good. Oh, man, you know, that kind of loyalty, that kind of thought does not exist in Hollywood by any means. The man is a rarity, and I practically, you know, wept when I saw him and he said that. There are only superlatives that come to mind when I think of Adam. He's just a terrific guy.
I wish I had more time because I really I enjoy talking to you. I love the book. I wish we had more time, but we don't.
Yeah.
But I really enjoy talking to you, and I want to wish you a lot of luck selling the book, Barry, and hopefully we can talk another time.
Appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.